This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we remember historian, theologian, and civil rights activist Dr. Vincent Harding.
This close advisor to Dr. King was a key author of the important speech Beyond Vietnam, A Time to Break the Silence.
Stay with us.
New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, Executive Director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, President Emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Michael, last week we learned that government informant known as Sabu is not going to be serving any additional jail time.
I imagine most of our listeners know who Sabu was. It's Monsengor. He was the informant, or at least the government made him into an informant, in the group Anonymous and into some subgroups of that, that eventually wound up with the evidence that convicted Jeremy Hammond, the person who was serving a 10-year sentence for hacking into Stratfor and other websites. Sabu received essentially a time-served sentence, 7 months, and a year of probation, or not probation, but supervised release while they look at what he does on a computer. But I know, Heidi, you had some reaction to Judge Preska, who sentenced him, who was the same sentencing judge for Jeremy, and some reaction to what she said and how she lauded Sabu's work.
It was such a contrast, Michael, to how she treated Jeremy. And listeners may recall that many of us felt Loretta Preska should have recused herself from this case because her husband was one of the individuals whose information or name came out during some of the hacks.
But the Stratfor files.
The Stratfor files, right.
But she didn't.
She didn't.
And she was nasty about it.
And she was nasty and she was harsh. And yet, in the New York Times story last week, she was quoted as really praising Sabu as essentially performing a great public service. It was quite a contrast.
Yes, the contrast is amazing because essentially both Jeremy Hammond and Sabu are hackers.
Right.
And it's just that one's hacking on the side the government likes and one's hacking to give us information that we should have. So here you have someone who's hacking for the government, really, and I'll explain that in a second, and doing work for which his handlers and the FBI and the government should be going to jail, violating not just computer fraud laws, but as part of a broad government cyber warfare against countries, websites, and everything. And yet the person who winds up in prison for 10 years is Jeremy Hammond, who actually was trying to give us information. But the interesting thing is about how this unfolded. They eventually, or somehow they got to Sabu, and they turned him into an informant very quickly. He had two children at home, apparently, or two stepchildren, however it happened. But they then continued with him working with this, whether it were chat room or chat logs and other people in Anonymous. And they apparently were feeding him, it's not 100% proven, but it appears that they were feeding him websites to go into and hack. And then using what they called their chief cyber criminal, is the word
right,
they said,
right.
Jeremy Hammond, who made it sound like he's like the genius of the world.
The mastermind.
Which, right. I mean, yeah. He may be the genius of the world, but they made it sound like he was like, you know, the major figure out there that they had to get. But the key they did with Sabu is they apparently would feed him, we want to go attack a website of this country. I don't recall the countries or if they were mentioned. Some were mentioned briefly. They were redacted from various statements. And some 2,000 domains that they apparently either suggested or maybe Sabu did on his own. But here you have the FBI having given Sabu a computer to download everything that he that's hacked by this group. And then you have Sabu online apparently instructing, or not instructing, but asking people like Hammond to help hack into various government websites. And who should know, but in fact it appears that the FBI is behind this and using these very, very strong, astute, smart hackers to do the dirty work of the federal government in hacking into other websites. Now, the government claims they were doing it to then tell those countries or et cetera that they had weaknesses and there were back doors and vulnerabilities. But if you believe the government, the next thing you'll do is allow me to sell you the Brooklyn Bridge. So we have this outrageous situation, again, in which the government, which is doing cyber warfare all over the world, against everybody, surveilling everybody, then using an informant to get other hackers to help in its dirty business, this rotten government doing illegal activities all over the world, it's not going to jail. Its people aren't going to jail. The people going to jail are the people trying to reveal for all of us the information we need for a democracy. Can you find many more disgusting moments in our federal courtrooms? I doubt it. Heidi?
And Michael, Judge Preska said she was impressed with Sabu's, quote, turning on a dime and doing good and not evil, and also his extraordinary cooperation.
What do we make with that, except that, you know, turning on a dime shows the wonderful politics of the informant, but it also, let's be honest, the power of the federal government is extraordinary. Mm-hmm. They can destroy people, and they do. You know, whatever Sabu did, his choice was that or being destroyed. And then they use him to try and destroy others and use him to destroy websites. And I don't know if there's such a thing as pure evil, but this government is certainly creeping right up there.
It's dirty business. Michael Ratner, 2 weeks ago, we lost General Gordon Baker Jr. Tell us who he was.
You know, some of my friends have described General Baker, who was from Detroit, as one of the greatest working-class heroes in the United States. He's legendary for his role in having led the black auto workers in the 1960 Detroit Wildcat strikes against automakers and discriminatory union leaders. He was a founder of DRUM, and the League of Revolutionary Black Workers. In the book, Detroit, Do I Mind Dying?, about the worker revolts of that period, he is called the soul of the movement. That book is widely recognized as one of the most important books on the black liberation movement and labor struggles in the United States. His wife was quoted in the paper after his death. He's been protesting in the 60s, not only fair housing, but he's been in the union protesting. He's been out there protesting against injustice. My family knew how much he loved us, but we knew how much he loved the workers of the world. As one of my friends said about Baker, quoting Bertolt Brecht, those that fight their whole lives are the indispensable ones. General Baker was absolutely one of the indispensable ones. And Heidi, he wrote, he became well-known, of course, during the 60s for leading the wildcat strikes against the auto plants. But he also wrote a remarkable, utterly remarkable letter to the draft board when they tried to draft him in Vietnam. And you can read some of the excerpts, and we'll try and post a link. We will post a link up on our website. Heidi?
And this letter was reprinted in the book called Autobiography of a People, edited by Herb Boyd, and in part it reads, "Gentlemen, this letter is in regards to a notice sent to me, General Gordon Baker Jr., requesting my appearance before an examining station to determine my fitness for military service. How could you have the nerve, knowing that I am a black man living under the scope and influence of America's racist, decadent society? You did not ask me if I had any morals, principles, or basic human values by which to live. Yet, you ask if I am qualified. Qualified for what, might I ask? What does being qualified mean? Qualified to serve in the U.S. Army? To be further brainwashed into the insidious notion of defending freedom? You stand before me with the dried blood of Patrice Lumumba on your hands, the blood of defenseless Panamanian students shot down by U.S. Marines, the blood of my black brothers in Angola and South Africa who are being tortured by the Portuguese and South African whites, whom you resolutely support, respectively, the dead people of Japan, Korea, and now Vietnam in Asia, the blood of Medgar Evers, 6 Birmingham babies, the blood of 1 million Algerians slaughtered by the French, whom you supported, the fresh blood of 10,000 Congolese patriots dead from your ruthless rape and plunder of the Congo, the blood of defenseless women and children burned in villages from napalm jelly bombs. With all of this blood on my non-white brothers dripping from your fangs, you have the damned audacity to ask me if I am qualified? White man, listen to me, for I am talking to you. And, Michael, the letter goes on. It's a powerful, powerful indictment that everyone should read, and we will post on the website.
And everyone should really know about General Baker. One of our co-hosts, Michael Smith, was actually in Detroit at the time, and his firm was part of the representation of the League of Revolutionary Black Workers. I'm sure Michael will have some comments next week about this. As one of my friends who worked with General Baker said, I am sorry to miss his memorial, but I will raise my fist in solidarity with someone who fought and represented the best of humanity. General Baker presente.
Michael, last week we mentioned that the U.S. has been conducting mass surveillance of all communications, and we're talking content, not just metadata, of two countries, one of which we know is the Bahamas, but we didn't know the other country.
But the other country was censored out of the Washington Post articles and the articles in The Intercept, which is, of course, Glenn Greenwald's Laura Poitras, that publication, which is published by eBay chairman Pierre Omidyar. Now, Washington Post didn't publish any of the countries, not the two countries and not three other ones in which they were taking in the metadata.
They didn't even mention the Bahamas.
Nothing. The Intercept, in terms of taking in the content of phone calls, mentioned the Bahamas, but said, because the name of the second country might lead to a, quote, rise in violence, they were not going to mention the second country. I thought this was a bit peculiar because it's been out there for a year that the Snowden documents have been known to the government. They could have warned anybody they wanted to. They've been releasing these documents. So why all of a sudden, a year later, do they think that it's necessary to actually censor the name of the second country? Well, WikiLeaks put out a statement. I don't recall if it was put out by the time we talked last week, that said they would identify the country in 72 hours. And WikiLeaks, to its credit, identified the country. So now we can tell everybody the country that we all probably could have guessed last week. If the U.S. was going to try and get the surveillance of every phone call in a particular country, the content, what would it be? Well, why was it the Bahamas? I can't figure out exactly. But it was Afghanistan.
Right.
And WikiLeaks put out a statement saying, WikiLeaks statement on the mass recording of Afghan calls by the NSA. So the country is Afghanistan. What they say as to why they put it out, they read a statement, which people can go to the WikiLeaks site and see, and says, we know from previous reporting that a National Security Agency's mass interception system is a key component in the United States drone targeting program. The U.S. drone targeting program has killed thousands of people and hundreds of women and children in Afghanistan, Pakistan, Yemen, and Somalia in violation of international law. And it said, and then the WikiLeaks goes on to say, censorship of a victim state's identity directly assists the killing of these innocent people. So WikiLeaks makes a very strong statement as to why it's giving out the name of that country. And it goes on to say that almost every office in Washington, D.C. has been specifically aware of the material relating to the victim country since at least March 18, 2014, a couple of months ago, when the Washington Post issued a front-page story on the subject with the identity of Afghanistan censored out. It seemed pretty obvious to people at that point. And what it says, the statement goes on, it's the U.S. government's responsibility, quote, to protect its assets. It has had an egregious amount of time to do so. Given the above, WikiLeaks says, we believe any ongoing perceived risks to be fanciful or willfully embraced by the U.S. government. We also reject the implication that it's the role of the international press to protect U.S. assets from arrest for the mass infringement of the rights of another nation's people.
Now, Michael, what was the response, if any?
The response, not only from the administration, but from the entire United States press, has been non-existent.
Nil.
No one has mentioned it. Not one newspaper mainstream newspapers mention that Afghanistan is the other country, which just shows how a press can be intimidated. Here it's been out in the press, really, in a way, since certainly March, according to WikiLeaks, but probably for a year in terms of the people in Afghanistan saying, geez, everything's being surveilled. You know, what are we doing? And then it took WikiLeaks to actually name Afghanistan.
Well, but Obama has a new policy effective a few weeks ago saying that administration members aren't allowed to comment on certain issues like this. Do you think that could be related to it?
Well, administration, maybe. But what about all the newspapers? They won't even reprint WikiLeaks statement.
Right.
So there you go. And then, of course, when they – anyway, that's all. So it's really, to me
– But why the Bahamas?
Well,
we still don't know.
It may have been they're experimenting. You know, taking
in
all the content of phone calls is a huge undertaking, the amount of material. And what they did is, with the Bahamas, they get into these countries, in the Bahamas, through the back door of saying this is for drug enforcement.
Right.
They get access to the phone records, and then they start taking in everything. My guess
is the
Bahamas— Could
have been a pilot program in a way.
That's my guess. Mm-hmm. And it's a smaller country. They get everything.
Right.
But, of course, it's not just people who live in the Bahamas and citizens of the Bahamas, as bad as that is.
Everyone who visits.
5 million Americans visit the Bahamas every year, and they all use mobile phones. That's all taken in. Our friend Oprah Winfrey has a house in the Bahamas, apparently. Her phone calls are up there. So there you go. So we have to really thank WikiLeaks. And, of course, I represent them. There's no conflict in that, but I'm just saying I do. And I just think it was very important that they were willing to say, we will not be censored on this issue of Afghanistan.
Michael Ratner, I understand that you serve on several boards and advisory boards, but now there will be one less commitment, and that's to the International Center for Ethics, Justice, and Public Life at Brandeis.
You know, I went to Brandeis. I'm one of their, quote, honored graduates, etc. My picture hangs next to Tom Friedman's in the president's office.
Or did.
Or did. So I resigned from the board. And I wrote a long letter to the president, and I made it public. And the Forward, which is the major Jewish paper in the United States, published the letter. And so if people want to read the letter, they can go to the Forward. But here's briefly, in a nutshell, what happened. Judge Goldstone, interestingly, is chairman of the board. And, of course, he wrote the Goldstone Report and then, of course, has the various retractions from his strong statement of apartheid Israel. Whatever people want to say about that, and, of course, we were all upset that he retracted that. But I serve on that board. It's a small board of 10 people from around the world. I probably would say I'm
the most radical.
Well, by a long distance. but they somehow have tolerated me on that board. But what came up recently, there was another member of the board who was an acquaintance of mine, Sari Nasseba, Palestinian scholar, philosophy scholar, very well known, but also president of Al-Quds University in Jerusalem. Al-Quds is a major university in Jerusalem, Palestinian university. And Sari Nasseba is known among most people as a, quote, moderate Palestinian, which is, you know, I think a two-state solution person. He has, you know, contacts with Israeli institutions, etc. And he had been put on the board, and I like Sari, and he was a good person on the board. And Brandeis also had a relationship with Al-Quds University. I don't think it was a joint
degree. Like an exchange?
Yeah, exchange and programs and all kinds of things they did together.
I think the Guild years ago did something in support, too.
Wouldn't surprise me. And, you know, some other colleges have relationships with Al-Quds and with Sari. And I also, just as a full accounting here, I and the center represent Sari Nasseba's family, along with the Khalidi family and other families who are protesting the building of the Simon Wiesenthal Center of Tolerance on the Muslim cemetery in central Jerusalem.
And we covered that on Law and Disorder.
I mean, you can't make this stuff up, but that's what they're doing.
They're going ahead with that.
Nasseba and the Khalidis, their graves of their ancestors go back to the Saracens in the 12th century. They're like very, you know, deeply
rooted
in the Palestinian land and country. And so I represent Sari on that, along with the Khalidis and a number of other prominent Palestinian families. So Sari's on the board with me here. And maybe a year ago, there was a demonstration at Al-Quds by one of the student groups at Al-Quds. And it was a very anti-Israel demonstration. At Al-Quds, each of the student groups at Al-Quds is affiliated with various other factions of Palestinians. So you have a group that's affiliated with Hamas, a group that's affiliated with the PA, group that, anyway, many different groups, and they all do demonstrations as they have a right to do under what their version of the First Amendment, but right. a free expression. But this demonstration apparently got out of hand a little bit and was more antithetical to Israel and offensive to many, including the president of the university, Sari Nusseibeh, who condemned the demonstration and said it went beyond the guidelines for demonstrations at Al-Quds, and we've taken this to task, and we've tightened the regulations, and we've, you know...
Do you mean it went beyond the guidelines? What happened?
Oh, you know, you can go on site and watch it, but, you know, it was like...
Were the police involved?
Depends on what... how you interpret the pictures, you know, and what the pictures were, and of course stamping on Israeli flags and things like that.
But yeah, symbolic speech.
But whatever the whatever the demonstration was, which we don't necessarily have to agree with here or there or anywhere, it was one of the factions that represents the student movement.
Right.
So Sari condemned it, at least Sari condemned it, said this was unacceptable, it wasn't right, and you can go look at his statement. And then the president of Brandeis, who's a new president, who wasn't there when I was appointed to this board, basically without...
And this is President Lawrence.
President Fred Lawrence, dean of maybe Washington University and the college, or no, the law school in Washington, D.C.
Meaning he...
has a First Amendment-y free speech, you know, background. But without telling Judge Goldstone, who heads my board, without telling anybody, he just... wrote Sari a letter saying you're removed from the board. You're suspended from the board.
Unilateral suspension?
Just suspended him. So that upset, to their credit, my board, while they're divergent from me in opinions, particularly about Palestine, they were really upset. At the process and condemned the president's removal of Sari Nusseibeh. The president then also suspended the relationship with Al-Quds. So at that point, Sari Nusseibeh says, that's it. I'm done with Brandeis. I don't want any relationship with Brandeis. If you guys want to negotiate getting back involved with Al-Quds, you can negotiate with other people. I'm finished. And that was the end. So I basically said, "What? This is ridiculous. This is one of the most moderate Palestinians. Brandeis can't even deal with and have a relationship with a university in Jerusalem that actually has relationships with Israeli institutions and has the most moderate of people on our board." And so I wrote a letter to the president, which I made public in the foreword, giving the facts, because Brandeis then sent a fact-fighting group to find out about
what happened.
And they all came back against the president of Brandeis. They all came back and said, this was crazy what you guys did here. This is the most upsetting thing to the university, that people, you've besmirched Sari Nusseibeh's reputation by removing him from the board. And so you can read the last two paragraphs of my letter, or the last one, in which I say, it's not Sari Nusseibeh's reputation that's besmirched. It's Brandeis and yours, President Lawrence.
But I have a question. What did the trustees of Brandeis, don't they oversee President Lawrence?
Yes.
What did they say?
That's a good question. How is this president really going to last? I mean, of course, they're like, these people are the big, wealthy Zionist funders of Brandeis. So my guess is, you know, perhaps this is a way to move Brandeis away from even a sort of toying politics, you know, with Palestinians, to more and more in the Zionist camp. That's conceivable, that major funders on the trustees, which I was not.
Right.
Anyway, let's finish that.
Well, Michael, I just want to let listeners know, I just want to read a few sentences from your letter, because we have to put this in context of your relationship. You say, well, I feel that your decision requires me to take these actions of resigning. I do so with some reluctance because of my long association with Brandeis. As you are aware, I was an alumnus of Brandeis from the 1960s and attended during the time of the Civil Rights Movement and the beginning of the Vietnam War protests. The school began to open my eyes to liberal and progressive politics. It was a place of intense discussion and debate with professors like Herbert Marcuse and speakers such as Malcolm X, Allen Ginsberg, and Paul Goodman. As I said when Brandeis gave me the 2006 Alumni Achievement Award, quote, "Those years really changed my life. It's clear that Brandeis is where I became an activist." Michael, that's heavy stuff, sever your relationship with the institution that really was so instrumental in shaping who you are.
You know, I'm very angry about
what happened. Did they respond?
I doubt they'll do anything. And there's more I can say, but I'll just read how I ended the letter. everybody who the fact-finding team met with said that the most harmful result of Brandeis University's actions was the damage to the reputation and dignity of their president, Sari Nusseibeh, wrought by the cumulative effect of the suspension of the partnership, of the language about Dr. Nusseibeh's statement and repeated by the international press, and of the suspension of Dr. Nusseibeh from the advisory board of the Board of Ethics, where I am. And that, so what I conclude is, yes, in some communities, especially those that have embraced stereotyped views of Palestinians, Dr. Nusseibeh's reputation may have been harmed. But for those who understand a more nuanced picture of these events and are aware of what is occurring in Palestine and Israel, it is the reputation of Brandeis and yourself, the president of Brandeis, that have been damaged by these actions. And I conclude, I cannot countenance these actions by you or Brandeis, or be seen to endorse them by remaining on the board or continuing to support Brandeis. Apparently, even those Palestinians with the most moderate views are unacceptable partners and colleagues. That is unacceptable to me. Mm. So, yeah.
Michael, what about the remaining members of the advisory board?
You know, I have no complaints about the advisory board. They were very good and very good with me. Because I'm divergent on that board. Mm-hmm. You know, they hold judges seminars in Tel Aviv, and I wouldn't go to Tel Aviv. So this is a, but they would.
So they're not going to resign and protest.
They're not going to resign, but they did heavily object to the removal of Sari Nusseibeh from the board. And so can I ask them more? No, but they were very strong on that issue. And I appreciate it, and I had a good working relationship with them. And in some way, because it was a bit of a debating society with me on one side of it, it was informative and helpful to me. Mm-hmm. But, you know, this is outrage. What's happening, I think, in a broad way is, as the narrative on Palestine is changing in this country, as we're getting more Students for Justice in Palestine on campuses,
we're seeing a narrowing and a crackdown on the remaining institutions.
That's what I would say is happening, that they're really coming down. And that's the context I would put this in.
Over the past few years, we've talked about progress that the Coalition of Immokalee Workers has made with tomato workers, and they have a campaign with Wendy's.
The Coalition of Immokalee Workers, as we've covered on this program a number of times, has done remarkable work over 20 years. Every fast food chain in the country is part of the Fair Food Program, which is an enforced program of more payment, a penny a pound, but it amounts to a third, at least, increase in wages for the tomato pickers, and also ended abuse in the fields. You can go into farms and monitor them. You have hotlines for complaints. That includes all kinds of abuse, from slavery to sexual abuse. It's been a remarkable set of victories with the fast food chains, except for Wendy's. It's been a pretty remarkable victory with a number of...
And the grocery store.
Grocery stores. Yep. Not the big supermarkets yet, except they had a settlement with Walmart about 2 months ago, which is huge because Walmart controls 20% of the tomato crops in the United States. Now, we
Walmart.
All have a huge number of critiques of Walmart, and you could argue that they're doing this for whatever reasons,
right.
But in fact, they did it. And so Walmart's is now part of the fast food program in Florida and in some other states, which is really interesting. But Wendy's is incredibly a holdout. As we speak on this Wednesday, there is a big demonstration in Columbus, Ohio, which is Wendy's headquarters, where they're having their annual meeting. And the annual meetings, of course, there's always workers from CIW and others speaking at the annual meeting. Why are you not paying?
Really? They allow them in.
They're allowed in. Shareholders. They come in through one of the church groups or something that own shares.
Right.
And they come in and they speak. And it's shocking to me that Wendy's is still holding out. But I mention it because today is the demonstration in Columbus. It should be a huge demonstration. And I mention it, of course, but he would never want to be mentioned because it's always, he's not a worker. He just works for the Coalition of Immokalee Workers.
That would be Jake.
Jake Ratner is in Columbus, having been one of the main people organizing the demonstrations. But he always he'd kill me because it's really only workers that... and CIW who actually are put before the microphone, which
but
is, of course, correct.
But he's doing amazing work.
But he's there, and I miss him today, and I'm sorry I didn't get to Columbus today. But let's hope that Wendy's sees the light. And you can go to the CIW website, which is CIW-online.org. That's CIW-online.org. Find out about their campaign. support them as you can, and fight to make sure Wendy's signs.
Now, is CIW calling for a boycott of Wendy's by the public?
They're not calling for a boycott yet. What they do is they go into the stores, they try and talk to the managers, they ask people who go into Wendy's, if you're going to go into Wendy's, talk to them about the fact that they alone out there have not signed the Fair Food Agreement, and it's really an outrage.
It's an outrage. Michael, we have an exciting offer for our listeners. Glenn Greenwald, as you know, is in the United States talking about his new book, No Place to Hide, Edward Snowden, the NSA and the U.S. Surveillance State. And we have 5 tickets in 6 different U.S. cities that we'd like to give to listeners.
First of all, I mean, we all know who Glenn Greenwald is. The book that Heidi referred to, No Place to Hide, is incredible. And, of course, to hear Glenn live talk about it will be a remarkable and historic experience. And the promoters of the book tour for Glenn, Haymarket Books, have offered us 5 tickets in each of 6 venues. Now, listen carefully, because we will tell you the 6 venues, and then we will ask you the question you have to answer to get yourself a ticket, and we will give you the email. So first, Heidi, what are the 6 venues?
In order of appearance.
And dates.
And date. Seattle, Washington, June 17th. San Francisco, California, June 18th. Los Angeles, California, June 19th. San Diego, June 21st. And then, coming to the East Coast, New York on June 23rd. And Rosemont, Illinois on June 26th.
What is that about? But anyway, Rosemont, Illinois. So all of you listeners out there in these areas or who want to get free tickets to one of these 6 venues, you heard the dates.
Email us.
Email us. We will give you the email and we will post on our site the 6 venues.
And to email us, go to the lawanddisorder.org website and click on contact. And you can send an email to our producer. Now, we have 5 tickets. So the first 5...
We have 5 tickets for each venue.
Exactly. But the first 5 in each venue will get, if they answer the question correctly, will get a single ticket each. Now, the question, Michael. What 2 countries was it recently revealed that the NSA is taking in the contents of all communications?
What 2 countries? Well, I'm not sure.
Tick, tock, tick. In your email contact communication, you please need to say which location you're in. So if you're in L.A., Rosemont, Illinois, New York, Seattle, just indicate that venue, answer the question, and provide your contact information.
The venues and dates will be listed on our website, lawanddisorder.org. Go there. And then email us the answer to the question, and we will make arrangements for you to get your free ticket to one of the Glenn Greenwald lectures at one of these 6 venues.
Now, it's the first time we're doing this, and we're excited about it, and we hope it works out.
We do hope it works out. We know the speech will be good.
Right.
The mechanics of us doing this is not something we're used to, but we will make our best efforts.
We will.
Thank you all for listening to
Law and Disorder, and good luck answering the trick question.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
I hope I'm one who can truly say that he has found a better way.
Last month, pioneering historian, theologian, and civil rights activist, Dr. Vincent Harding died at the age of 82. Harding was a close advisor to Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and wrote King's famous anti-war speech, Beyond Vietnam, A Time to Break the Silence. King delivered the speech at Riverside Church in New York on April 4, 1967. After King was assassinated, Harding became the first director of the Martin Luther King Jr. Memorial Center and of the Institute of the Black World. He later became professor of religion and social transformation at Iliff School of Theology in Denver. After serving in the Army for several years, Harding became a pacifist and later served as co-chairman of the social unity group, the Veterans of Hope Project. He's the author of numerous books, including There is a River and Wade in the Water, The Wisdom of the Spirituals. Joining us to remember Dr. Vincent Harding is his colleague at the Iliff School of Theology, Dr. Tinker. He teaches courses in American Indian cultures, history, and religious traditions, cross-cultural and third-world theologies, and justice and peace studies. He is a frequent speaker on these topics both in the United States and internationally. Dr. Tinker, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Good to be with you.
Now, today we're remembering Vincent Harding. We wanted to ask you if you could tell us a bit about him as a person and how people responded to him.
Vincent is, first of all, the person who is responsible for my coming to Iliff School of Theology. I was the fulfillment of a promise that the institution made to Vincent in the early 80s that he would not be the only faculty person of color. It took them 5 years before they hired me, but he was on that search committee, so I always told him privately and publicly he was responsible for any trouble I caused at Iliff. And he graciously accepted that responsibility. Vincent sometimes was called by black activists across the continent the gentle giant. Giant not because of his physical size, but because of his intellectual stature. Gentle because that characterized who he was. And I saw him, interacted with him both in the classroom and on the faculty and in other public venues. Last summer we did a conference together speaking to a national conference of Quakers. He was an incredibly soft-spoken and gentle person, yet could be so absolutely incisive in his quiet comments, meaning that no students, no audience participants, no faculty person was suddenly off the hook once he had spoken. It was so persuasive that everyone had to pay attention to him. That was his voice. And I think if one doesn't understand both the gentleness and the incisiveness, they don't capture the intellectual greatness of this gentle giant.
Not only was he an author of over 20 books on the civil rights movement, but he played an active part in shaping what he called the Southern Freedom Movement. And even at the time of his death, I understand he was on an East Coast speaking tour. What was his activism like on campus?
Well, first of all, we were all students were absolutely aware of his power. That is, you know, his spiritual energy, his intellectual energy, and his public presence across the continent. They were aware of it, proud of it. On our campus, it depended on the situation. He was either in the midst of a student group trying to quietly cajole them into activism themselves, or once students did become activists, he was one of the few faculty who was right there with students walking them through that activism. He and I and one or two others For instance, in the mid-90s, when a student group was protesting racism in the institution, at some point they decided to occupy the chapel. Vincent sat with them through the night on one occasion, but certainly sat with them as the president of the institution saw fit to bring in heavily armed Denver police officers to arrest the students, remove them, and take them off to jail. It's the only time I know of that we permitted armed weapons in the chapel at Iliff. And he sat there with them through all of that, helping them through it, helping them to understand that their protest was worth, you know, the personal discomfort of going through not just the protest, but the arrest.
We wanted to ask you about the 1967 speech Beyond Vietnam that Dr. Martin Luther King delivered in New York City at Riverside Church.
Yes, ma'am.
How did Dr. Harding reflect on his contribution to that?
Harding never used any of his past history in order to advance himself personally. In other words, he was not a bragger. Generally, we knew about that speech because others were talking about it in terms of Vincent. He didn't go back there himself to claim any of that glory. I mean, that's part of his deep, deep humility. He was spiritually too rich, intellectually too rich, to need to simply remember what he had done in the past. He was always pushing students into the next step.
You know, it's amazing to hear you say that about him because, you know, I was at the university at the time nearby where he gave that speech, and it's probably my single favorite King speech, and in my view, one of his most important, when he talks about, you know, the triplets of materialism, racism, and militarism. And it's a remarkable speech, and that Dr. Harding never would reflect on the fact that he was, you know, very involved in the content of that speech, I find, you know, just incredible in terms of his humility. I mean, if I had written three words of that speech, I would be I'd be out on the front pages anyway.
Yeah.
What can I tell you? I mean, I really appreciate the way you're talking about him because he sounds I never really knew him.
Yeah. On the other hand, everything in that speech is a part of what Vincent lived every day. If one wanted to know who Vincent Harding was, they could read that speech, and within 2 minutes of meeting the man, they would understand a great deal about him, because he walked this speech every day. One of the photos circulating on the internet after his death is a photograph of Vincent wearing a round button that says, "War is terrorism." He wore that every day at Iliff. As far as I know, he wore it everywhere he went.
It basically said, "All war is terrorism," right?
Yeah, right.
Was he in the military at some point and became a pacifist?
He was in the Army during the Korean War, that's right.
And then he became a pacifist. Amazing.
Yeah, became a Mennonite and just a thoroughgoing convert to Gandhian nonviolence theory.
And his students in the campus must understandably be very sad at his loss. Were students moved to action in terms of activism and peaceful initiatives?
In a variety of ways. Now, in that Vietnam speech, about two-thirds of the way through, King makes a shift. and fleshes out the Beyond Vietnam part of the title. He goes on to say that the war in Vietnam is but a symptom of a far deeper malady within the American spirit. That, too, is very much part of who Vincent was. And his participation in bringing me to ILF was a clear signal that he was one of those civil rights warriors who was not satisfied with interpreting the civil rights struggle as a black and white issue, and immediately knew that there were other groups of racialized people on the continent who were affected by racism. So that when we engaged in protest here on the streets of Denver, beginning about 1989, getting ready for the 1992 Columbian quincentenary, you know, we had ILF students who would come out with the American Indian Movement of Colorado to help us protest what we always framed as state-supported hate speech. You know, we were never against a few people celebrating Italian heritage. But it's the fact that Columbus Day is, you know, a federal holiday, and is a federal celebration then of the genocide of Indian people. By 2007, we had students arrested who were treated very badly on the streets, and yet their protest was nonviolent. They knew they might be hurt, and they were hurt. The city of Denver, which had been fairly reasonable in their treatment of our protest up until then, decided to use that October 2007 protest as a warm-up for the Democratic National Convention that happened the next spring.
And Dr. Harding co-founded a couple of organizations, one, the National Council of Elders, and earlier, with his wife, the Mennonite House, which was one of the first interracial gathering spots in the South.
Yes. Here at ILF, before he retired, and he continued to run it up until his death, he founded the Veterans of Hope Project, which was an attempt to recapture some of the history of that civil rights struggle. Doing videotaping of key civil rights activists and intellectual participants.
On this radio show, we cover a lot to do with, obviously, in New York, where there's these incredible demonization and attacks on Muslims and Muslim religion. And, you know, we represent a number of people who've been attacked. And Dr. Harding was apparently very vocal on this issue.
Of course, he saw that. Like he saw other racialized communities in North America as part and parcel of what black folk were struggling with then and continuing to struggle with today. So the demonization of Islam in North America was very much part of his concern that be countered, that we come to an understanding that these are human beings too. Almost 2 years ago, a year and a half ago, he joined a group of Jewish activists and African Americans, in a trip to Palestine, to the West Bank. And he came back deeply affected by that. The simple support of the State of Israel's violence here in the U.S., both because of U.S. foreign policy commitments to the State of Israel and the fact that the press, by and large, has been so hyper-supportive of Israel. He came back deeply affected, and immediately when he was over there began to understand the deep, deep connection between the Palestinian struggle for freedom and American Indian struggle on this continent.
Wow, that's remarkable, because, I mean, we cover that a lot, and of course, as you said, in this country, I mean, the uncritical support of Israeli violence is something that happens every day here, and that he was willing to take a position which would be
relatively unpopular here is really a strong statement.
Well, as you know, King's speech was unpopular, both in the body politic among left-leaning Americans in 1967 and even among many African-Americans in the Civil Rights Movement.
The NAACP called the speech a tactical error at the time.
Yeah, right.
You know, one thing that always struck me in the speech was when you talk about his pacifist and anti-war stance is he talks, of course, a lot about the Vietnam War. And then he mentions Venezuela, where apparently the U.S. was intervening at that period with helicopters, etc. And then King goes on to say, unless we get at the core of what's going on here, militarism, as we said, racism and materialism, we will be marching against wars again and again and again.
Yes.
And, of course, could you think of anything more prescient in your life? I mean, I don't know what your age is, but that's what I've been doing since I was a kid in Vietnam. And it goes on. And so it was just, it's such a striking part of the speech to me.
Right. The point that this speech makes, all of this becomes a part of U.S. foreign policy, and becomes characteristic of U.S. foreign policy, and we project it into the future. And we're seeing it still today, where U.S. foreign policy is characterized by violence and the threat of violence. And if not military violence, economic violence. Because this is an exceptional country, we must be right. You know, we're the cowboys in the white hats, and everyone else in the world are Indians to be killed or controlled or brought into some kind of subservience to the intentions of this more exceptional, more moral, more civilized society called America. The violence is still going on.
Now, one thing I'm amazed by is the age of both Dr. Harding and Dr. King at the time of the speech. I mean, they were both under 40.
That's right.
I mean, what can I say?
Yep, that's right.
To make one of the most profound statements, you know, about this country that I think has probably been made in, you know, certainly in this last century, at their age was, I'm in shock and amazement by it.
And that that Vincent was able to convince King. He spent a couple of years bringing him around to the point where he was willing to give this speech, because it was not, you know, politically the smartest thing for a black civil rights leader to do at the time.
That part I don't think, you know, I know, but certainly we know that there was huge opposition to King doing this, and the civil rights, some people in the civil rights movement said, you have this deal with Johnson, let him go keep making the war, but he'll help you on civil rights, and if you do this, he might not help you on civil rights. I think that was the pressure.
No, that was the political trade-off, the threat, the risk that he took. On the other hand, Vincent, and in retrospect, King, were men of conscience, who once they understood the truth of what was happening in Vietnam, could not help but speak to it.
Yeah, of course, that's striking also in the speech, the what's happening in, I think they refer to in black community, and how young blacks are just being shot down in our own country, and how can we ask them to go shoot people of color in another country? I just think that was so dramatic in that speech.
And, of course, there was a superabundance of people of color in the U.S. Army in Vietnam, as is the case today in Iraq and Afghanistan. And it seems to be a target employment opportunity for poor people. And poor, when we say poor people, people of color tend to float to the top of those numbers.
And I find that just so horrible when I see each young person killed, you know, obviously the Iraqis or Afghans, when I see the American young people in their 20s, African-American, Latinos, some whites, you know, their choices, what are they? There's no employment. They're thrown on a pile of discards unless you can do this.
That's right. 18-year-old kids don't have, you know, the clear reading of history to fall back on in their decision-making.
Dr. Tinker.
Yes, ma'am.
It's been such a pleasure to talk to you today about Dr. Harding. As we leave, Could you just end on a few notes of the hope that I understand characterized Vincent Harding and that kept him working until he died? What words do you think he would give to young people today who find our situation despairing and sometimes a bit depressing?
He came in every year to a class I teach. There's a post-colonial historical treatment of modern Christianity, Christianity in the modern world. It's a course that traces the underside of that history and traces Euro-Christianity's history of violence. He came in to talk about the struggle of black folk in America, to talk about the survival from slavery and the fight through civil rights and what's, you know, right up what's going on now. And students by that point in the course, and this is about two-thirds of the way through the course, are beginning to feel a little depressed about what the prospects are for the future. And Vincent was wonderful in helping to convince them that this struggle is something that's not going to be solved by Sunday. It's not going to be solved this year, but it's a struggle to which they have to commit their lives for the sake of generations who come down the line. His hope was not for the near future, but his hope was to get enough people in solidarity with one another for justice and freedom, that we could begin to change the ideologies of America over time and over generations. That was his hope, and that's the work to which our students are committing themselves today. I just add to that only that his passing is a passing of an era, marked today by the passing of Maya Angelou, and it deeply, deeply saddened me because I was, for instance, hoping this next month to have lunch with him. So I'm deeply saddened, but at the same time, I'm fired up with the hope that he had that long term we are going to make a difference as more and more people begin to live the substance of that Vietnam speech.
Thank you so much for helping us remember Dr. Vincent Harding.
Really inspiring to hear you. And, you know, just keep up your incredible work, and we will all fight for the ideals. Dr. Harding.
And thank you for paying attention to my late colleague, that he might be remembered in a broader audience.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.